Translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. During our exile, Durvasa Muni, who eats with his 10,000 disciples, intrigued with our enemies to put us in dangerous trouble. At that time he, Lord Krishna, simply by accepting the remnants of food, saved us. By his accepting food thus, the assembly of Munis, while bathing in the river, felt sumptuously fed, and all the three worlds were also satisfied. Purport by Srila Prabhupada, and it's quite a long purport. It will probably take up most of the class, to your relief. So Prabhupada says, Durvasa Muni, a powerful mystic brahmana, determined to observe the principles of religion with great vows and under strict austerities. His name is associated with many historical events, and it appears that the great mystic could both be easily satisfied and easily annoyed, like Lord Shiva. When he was satisfied, he could do tremendous good to the servitor. But if he was dissatisfied, he could bring about the greatest calamity. Kumari Kunti, at her father's house, used to minister all kinds of services to all great brahmanas. And being satisfied with her good reception, Durvasa Muni benedicted her with a power to call any demigod she desired. It is understood that he was a plenary incarnation of Lord Shiva, and thus he could be either easily satisfied or annoyed. He was a great devotee of Lord Shiva, and by Lord Shiva's order, he accepted the priesthood of King Shvetaketu because of the king's performance of sacrifice for 100 years. Sometimes he used to visit the parliamentary assembly of the heavenly kingdom of Indradev. He could travel in space by his great mystic powers, and it is understood that he traveled a great distance through space, even up to the Vaikuntha planets beyond material space. He traveled all these long distances within 1 year during his quarrel with King Ambarish, the great devotee and emperor of the world. He had about 10,000 disciples, and wherever he visited and became a guest of the great Kshatriya kings, he used to be accompanied by a number of followers. Once he visited the house of Duryodhan, the enemy cousin of Maharaj Yudhishthir. Duryodhan was intelligent enough to satisfy the brahmana by all means, and the great Rishi wanted to give some benediction to Duryodhan. Duryodhan knew his mystic powers, and he knew also that the mystic brahmana, if dissatisfied, could cause some havoc. And thus he designed to engage the brahmana to show his wrath upon the enemy cousins, the Pandavas. When the Rishi wanted to award some benediction to Duryodhan, the latter wished that he should visit the house of Maharaj Yudhishthir, who was the eldest and chief among all his cousins. But by his request, he would go to him after he had finished his meals with his queen Draupadi. Duryodhan knew that after Draupadi's dinner, it would be impossible for Maharaj Yudhishthir to receive such a large number of brahmana guests, and thus the Rishi would be annoyed and would create some trouble for his cousin Maharaj Yudhishthir. That was the plan of Duryodhan. Durvasa Muni agreed to this proposal, and he approached the king in exile according to the plan of Duryodhan, after the king and Draupadi had finished their meals. On arrival at the door of Maharaj Yudhishthir, he was at once well received, and the king requested him to finish his noontime religious rites in the river, for by that time the foodstuff would be prepared. Durvasa Muni, along with his large number of disciples, went to take a bath in the river, and Maharaj Yudhishthir was in great anxiety about the guests. As long as Draupadi had not taken her meals, food could be served to any number of guests. But the Rishi, by the plan of Duryodhan, reached there after Draupadi had finished her meals. When the devotees are put into difficulty, they have an opportunity to recollect the Lord with rapt attention. So Draupadi was thinking of Lord Krishna in that dangerous position. And the all-pervading Lord could at once know the dangerous position of his devotees. He therefore came there on the scene and asked Draupadi to give whatever food she might have in her stock. On her being so requested by the Lord, Draupadi was sorrowful because the Supreme Lord asked her for some food and she was unable to supply it at that time. She said to the Lord that the mysterious dish which she had received from the sun god could supply any amount of food if she herself had not eaten. But on that day she had already taken her meals, and thus they were in danger. By expressing her difficulties, she began to cry before the Lord, as only a woman would do in such a position. The Lord, however, asked Draupadi to bring up the cooking pots to see if there was any particle of foodstuff left. And on Draupadi's doing so, the Lord found some particle of vegetable sticking to the pot. The Lord at once picked it up and ate it. After doing so, the Lord asked Draupadi to call for her guests, the company of Durvasa. Bhima was sent to call them from the river. Bhima said, "Why are you delaying, sirs? Come on, the food is ready for you." But the brahmanas, because of Lord Krishna's accepting a little particle of food, felt sumptuously fed, even while they were in the water. They thought that since Maharaj Yudhishthir must have prepared many valuable dishes for them, and since they were not hungry and could not eat, the king would feel very sorry, so it was better not to go there. Thus they decided to go away. This incident proves that the Lord is the greatest mystic, and therefore he is known as Yogeshwar. Another instruction is that every householder must offer food to the Lord, and the result will be that everyone, even a company of guests numbering 10,000, will be satisfied because of the Lord's being satisfied. That is the way of devotional service. Srila Prabhupada ki. Well, this is, we've just had a wonderful story related to us about Durvasa Muni. And this is one of the stories that he relates in his lamentation to King Yudhishthir. This is Arjun, of course. Arjun is describing these stories after having returned and witnessed the departure of Krishna. And so here he's just recollecting beautiful incidents that happened. And this is a trait of devotees, and we've seen it before. We've seen it with Bhishma Dev. We've seen it with Queen Kunti, how they recollect the pastimes that took place while they were in Krishna's presence. And an interesting theme comes out again here, that the presence of difficulties leads to a greater darshan of Krishna. Now for most of us, that is a tricky concept to understand. The idea that difficulties will lead to having a greater presence or connection with Krishna. It might do. To some extent, it depends upon our surrender and connection with Krishna. In this incident, Draupadi is praying to Krishna. Yudhishthir Maharaj is praying to Krishna when this incident with Durvasa Muni is taking place. They realize there is very little they can do to deal with this situation. But another person in that situation might not necessarily be thinking of Krishna with complete surrender. They might still be trying, using their own efforts, their own expertise, to try to solve the problem. So a devotee of Krishna, who sees Krishna as their lovable object at all times, only thinks about Krishna. So they don't really consider any maintenance or any assistance from outside of Krishna. Or at least we can say that even if they take assistance, maintenance, or help, as we all do from so many sources, still Krishna is the one they always think of when required. Now, when someone like Yudhishthir Maharaj thinks of Krishna, or Draupadi thinks of Krishna, or Queen Kunti thinks of Krishna, or Bhishma Dev thinks of Krishna, with a problem in mind that they want solved, artha arthi, right? That's the that's the category of approach to Krishna in that sense. That is different to the typical behavior of an artha arthi who wants relief from distress. They typically ignore Krishna most of the time. But when they have a shortage of either wealth or an excess of distress, or they want some knowledge, or they want something higher, maybe some realization, at that point they approach Krishna. So that's not so satisfying for Krishna. It's not so attractive to him. His devotees typically do not approach him for anything. At least they don't like to do so. They approach him with the mood of offering him something. They offer him worship. They try to take care of him. Here, as we see, look at Draupadi's mentality. She was so upset that she was unable to feed Krishna. Normally, it would be a great honor for her if Krishna turns up to offer something to Krishna. That's her mood. How can I please Krishna? So on this occasion, she's extremely upset that she's unable to serve Krishna, because there's nothing in the pot. Now, Krishna, when he hears that kind of prayer from the devotee, when Yudhishthira is praying, please save me from this calamity of Durvasa Muni, he can cause great harm if we displease him in some way. Please let us not make this this item of Vaishnava aparad to this great personality. So when Krishna hears that heartfelt prayer, he takes it much more seriously and intervenes much more personally than the typical artha-arthi who approaches Krishna when something is wrong or yet another material situation needs rectification. It's very interesting. To the extent that we are wholly and solely committed to Krishna and we want nothing from him, to that extent Krishna deals with whatever we want. It's a paradox which the karmis can't understand. It is true in that sense that devotees have no want of anything. We read that in the scriptures. They have no need of anything. And one of the ways to look at it is that if ever there is a need for a devotee, then Krishna will supply it somehow. Krishna will supply it either directly or through his devotees. So there's a little mood change or a mood adjustment that's required when someone comes closer to Krishna. And that's our theme for this year, coming closer to Krishna. And certainly in lockdown and in the whole situation that's been created, we've all had a chance to come closer to Krishna. Now, one of the items of coming closer to Krishna is that we think of him all the time. We try to serve him. We try to please him. We do all those things, and in that sense, we are actually closer to Krishna. Krishna is in the hearts of his devotees, he says. Now, Krishna is actually in the hearts of everyone as the Supersoul. So why does he specifically say, I'm in the heart of my devotees? The heart is a very close place to us, right? That's where we reside. The soul resides in the heart. And the heart often refers to our innermost consciousness. And that's where Krishna appears for his devotees, not for the karmis. For the karmis, he's still there as the Supersoul, but the relationship between the karmi soul, if such a term exists, the embodied soul who is currently behaving as a non-devotee, and the Supersoul is a distant one. It's always there. Two birds are sitting on the tree, but one is not saying anything. One is constantly chirping. Or if the other one says something, this person cannot hear because he's too busy chirping. That's the relationship between a materialist and the Lord, even though they're still close. But for a devotee, Krishna says, I specifically appear. I'm in the heart of my devotees. I'm with my devotees. Because they can directly feel his presence. Because they are completely surrendered to him. When they're chanting about Krishna, when they're thinking about Krishna, when they're meditating on how to serve Krishna, Krishna is actually there. He's actually there. And the devotees can actually perceive that. Even though separation may be there, he's still there. You have the Sambhoga Vipralamba, duality constantly going on, separation and union. And the strange thing is that in the material world, separation means separation. In the spiritual world, separation means union also. Because within the separation, there's the highest type of union. No one wants separation, but it comes because it gives the highest union while the separation is taking place. So therefore Krishna allows his devotees to be in separation. Now one has to be a little surrendered to Krishna to accept that. Otherwise one is resentful Krishna, why are you not present before me? Why aren't you doing this? I've got this difficulty. Why don't you sort it out right now? Krishna, come on. When is it going to happen? Okay, I've got the lotus flower like Gajendra. I've lifted it in the air. Krishna, I surrender. Where are you? Well, it's to do with Krishna. It's to do with Krishna and it's to do with the extent of our devotion. Krishna's not obliged to do anything for anyone. And he's not obliged to do anything for anyone in a way that they understand either. Krishna can do something for someone and they don't actually appreciate he's done something for them. Because Krishna is in control of a whole mystic realm of powers which most people do not perceive at all. He's in control of the entire material energy. He's ultimately in charge of all the laws of material nature. He's in charge of our karma. He's in charge of all the interactions of all the spirit souls in this world. Not just human, but all the rakshasas, the demigods, the animals, the beasts, the plants, Mother Earth. He's in charge of all of that. So Krishna, it's possible for Krishna to actually do something for us by manipulating all of these different things. Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda ki. It is possible for Krishna to do something for us by manipulating all of these distant energies in a way that benefits us, but in a way that we will never perceive. We simply won't know what Krishna has done. Sometimes, if we are due to receive a heavy dose of karma, Krishna might reduce it a lot, maybe a little. We just don't know. And it may be a token reaction that we end up getting. Now, Krishna's helped us in that situation, but we can't perceive it. So we think nothing's happened. So this is the dilemma that everyone will go through, always. That the help that Krishna provides may not necessarily be in the way that we are imagining it to be. And we can't say Krishna hasn't helped either, if we have difficulties. There are so many stories, so many sort of fables in our tradition of how, you know, something that appears to be good might not be so good, and something that appears to be bad may not be so bad after all. There's some different Chinese proverbs as well. There's a story of the horse. Godruma tells this story. Maybe at the end he can tell us. Story of the horse. Runs off, comes back with another horse. All these, you know, these pastimes. What actually happens is not clear. But a devotee doesn't get overly bothered. A devotee is thinking of the Lord constantly. So Draupadi, although she's in great anxiety, Yudhishthir, who is in great anxiety also, they're thinking of Krishna and they're hoping that something will happen. They don't really have in mind what would happen. I mean, think of the options that a typical person would expect. So one of the options would be that Krishna fills up the pot again, right? Or someone drops by and drops off a few items. A donation turns up. But they couldn't have imagined that Krishna would simply come himself, take a little grain of what was left in the pot, and by that way he would satisfy the hunger of all of the guests who had come. Now that's quite an amazing, it's quite an amazing way for Krishna to solve the problem. Quite unconventional. It gives devotees something to talk about for centuries afterwards, centuries and millennia afterwards. Is an object of great remembrance for Arjun and brought so much pleasure to Draupadi, to Yudhishthir Maharaj, to all the Pandavas, and also perhaps taught Durvasa Muni a lesson. So all of these things can be achieved by a plan executed according to Krishna's desire. A devotee just has to approach Krishna and just remember Krishna. And ironically, through that separation, one can be very close to Krishna. If one isn't particularly devoted to Krishna, then when there is separation from Krishna, there can be resentment. There can be frustration, dissatisfaction. But when one is connected to Krishna, even in separation, those things don't happen. As I mentioned, the highest type of ecstasy can happen in separation. Because one is simply thinking, meditating, how to do this, how to do this, how to carry out this activity. So Krishna deals with his devotees in a very, very friendly way. And he describes here the qualities of the devotees who are part of this lila. I mentioned a few of the devotees, Bhishma Dev, Queen Kunti. Their prayers, their respects, their behavior are so exemplary. And here Arjuna is being glorified a little bit. Here, Prabhupada is glorifying him that he's saying that he was able to reach the heavenly planet, even in his own self-same body. And he was actually honored by Indra, who normally takes honor from everyone else because he's the supreme head of the demigods. So, Arjuna's position is so extensive. He is so qualified. Earlier it was said that Durvasa Muni could travel anywhere in the world. Well, here it is described that Arjuna could also do the same. He could travel anywhere. And Prabhupada is saying, Arjuna was allowed to enter into the heavenly planets in the self-same body simply by the grace of the Lord. Otherwise, it is not possible to do so. The present attempts to enter into the heavenly planets by the modern scientists will certainly prove futile, because such scientists are not on the level of Arjuna. So this is an interesting aspect. The materialists will undertake so many efforts. They will make so many attempts, so much extensive labor in order to achieve a result. A devotee will think of Krishna. And if Krishna desires, that devotee will be empowered to do so much more than all the attempts of the materialists. That's a very interesting point. When we connect ourselves to the supreme Lord of everything that exists, the supreme source of all power, the supreme provider of everything, the supreme source of all happiness, then there is nothing that a devotee will go short for, ultimately. So, when we preach, we can consider the viewpoint of most people. In today's day and age, everyone is struggling. They're in difficulty. The situation is getting more difficult for many people. Now, we can blame Kali Yuga. We can blame Kali Yuga. But we can also blame ourselves, because we're not here by accident. We're not here in this age of Kali because someone made a mistake. Yamaraj got his sums wrong. It wasn't that he put us on the wrong train, and we were meant to end up in Indra's planet, but we ended up here, in this age of Kali. So no accident has taken place. We're here specifically because we need to be here. We're here specifically because we perhaps deserve to be here. Because we've done certain things that require Krishna's rectification from material energy. And if we desire for us to see that rectification in light of its connection with Krishna, that choice is ours. Do we want to look at those difficulties that are upon us in connection with Krishna? Or do we want to see those difficulties independent of Krishna? And do we want to put all our effort and energy into trying to resolve those difficulties with the same material means that we've been trying for year after year, lifetime after lifetime? Prabhupada would use the phrase spiritual solutions to material problems. By actually adopting a spiritual outlook to life, what we consider to be a material problem disappears, first of all, because it no longer becomes an object of great significance to us. After all, as we've described, our material constructions are compared to sandcastles on the beach. Prabhupada gives this analogy. We do a massive construction on the beach. It's a sandcastle. And it might look very nice. You might even win a competition for it. But as soon as the waves come in from the ocean, the waves come in from the sea, by the force of time it is destroyed and there's nothing left. So our attempts in this world, materially, to progress, are all compared to this. They simply evaporate in due course of time. But any attempts that we make to progress spiritually, they last forever. So that's the first thing that happens. When we look for a spiritual solution to a material problem, first of all, that very item that we consider to be a problem simply is reduced in significance back to a more sensible place. The second thing that could happen is that Krishna could actually deal with the material problem itself. Now, this one people always like to hear. Because the immediate thing that people want is that my material problem should go. They're not so interested if Krishna does something behind the scenes. If he arranges something, alters a little karma thread here, asks a demigod to do something here, changes the way Mother Earth responds to yet another of our transgressions against her. Those things then people are not really interested in, and they'll never thank Krishna for it. Mainly because they can't perceive it. So Krishna could do both of those things. Either he could directly deal with the problem, which everyone wants to hear, or he might do something else which alleviates that problem, or maybe a problem more to the root of that problem, maybe a more distant cause, through some action of his. So that's interesting. When Sudama went to see Krishna, Sudama left pretty much empty-handed. Right? Krishna didn't give him anything. I mean, he had a wonderful time. Krishna ate his remnants, effectively. I mean, his wife had collected all this chipped rice through begging, and Sudama had brought it in Krishna's presence, and Krishna had taken it from him, because he could see Sudama was upset at the thought that he would have to offer this. So Krishna took that, and they hosted him nicely. Krishna fanned him, washed his feet, drank the water, ate the rice, so many things. Lakshmi Devi had to stop him eating. She said, if you eat any more, I'll become obligated to him in a way that's impossible. It's impossible to deal with. If someone even serves you, I become obligated to that person. That's Lakshmi Devi's thinking. She's saying, okay, so stop there. One or two grains is enough. If you eat the whole lot, my time is fully gone. I won't be able to do anything. So there was a nice pastime, nice exchange, but essentially, Sudama left empty-handed. But the transformation happened back at home. Back at the home, when Sudama went home, his wife was there and he couldn't recognize her. She looked like some celestial maiden, completely transformed. And the house was like a palace. He couldn't recognize the house. And then there were servants running around, doing so many things, so many opulences, luxuries. So people like that story because it's one of these examples of both. Krishna does something distant by his mystic power, but it's something that's very visible to us. So people like that. But we should always be aware that that kind of privilege, where you can actually directly see Krishna's hand, is a very rare privilege. It's given to only select people. It's given only to Krishna's select entourage, which is chosen by him when he wants. For the rest of us, aspiring devotees, we may not tangibly see Krishna's presence for many years in many ways. Now, most devotees have experience of some of Krishna's interaction in their lives. They can definitely consider incidents in their life where they thought there is absolutely no way this happened randomly. We all know Krishna has done things in our life where there is no case, no sense that it was some chance event, some freak occurrence. we know Krishna did something. And he gave us that little flavor for that time. Here is something I've just arranged, 5 or 6 different situations, all for your benefit, all in one way, all in this very special way. So most people have that experience. We just need to think back and remember those experiences. When after some time Krishna is wanting us to do a bit more work, and he denies us the chance to have those experiences directly. So for most of us, most of the time, Krishna's hand in our lives is going to be imperceptible. It's going to be not apparent. The externals may sometimes go against us in a very severe way, a very serious way. The external visible effects, things that happen around us in the temple, outside the temple, wherever we are, they may physically appear to be going very much against us, not conducive for our spiritual progress, even, or to speak of material progress. But a devotee knows that there's Krishna's hand in the whole picture. And there are certain obligations upon me, utsahan, nishchaya, dheryat, patience, enthusiasm, eagerness. Those are the things we are supposed to do. When Krishna manifests himself or makes his actions or efforts visible, it's up to him. That's not us. That's not up to us. That's why we have this concept of patience. So dheryat allows us to go through troublesome situations in life, troublesome periods, patiently waiting Krishna's intervention. Patiently awaiting, we patiently await the results of our past misdeeds. Suffering. That's suffering. The results of our past misdeeds. And we patiently tolerate them, as the verse explains. And then, if we do that, then yes, the kingdom of God becomes our rightful claim. That if we simply tolerate whatever is coming to us as a manifestation of our past misdeeds, and we keep surrendering to Krishna, and we keep serving Krishna, then eventually we're with Krishna, and all of these issues just evaporate. So in this verse, there's an interesting philosophical point which is made about watering the root. Now we know that. We know that verse, sarvarhanam achyuteja, that by pranopahara chayatendriyanam sarvarhanam achyuteja, that by watering the root of the tree, the leaves, the twigs, the branches, they are all nourished. They're all given energy. And that's the point that Prabhupada makes here in connection with Krishna eating that one grain of vegetable from the pot of Draupadi. Now we shouldn't look at Krishna as a conveyor belt or as a factory operation where I just offer something to Krishna and he deals with the whole supply and distribution chain. That's not quite the spirit within which we're meant to see this concept. This concept is primarily used, especially used by our acharyas and Prabhupada, in the context of the demigods. The demigods are compared to the leaves and the twigs, the branches of the tree, the substance of which is Krishna, the root is Krishna. So when we offer something, if we're trying to please the demigods, we're trying to please all the living entities in this universe, it is much more effective to actually water the root of the plant than to water the leaves. Now sometimes we spray the leaves for different purposes, especially with Tulsi Devi. That's not so much for the purpose of feeding her. It can be, but it's not the most effective way of feeding a plant. A plant draws its nutrition from the soil, primarily. So when we actually offer to the soil, then all of the other elements and items within the whole system of Krishna are satisfied. And all the demigods, the living entities, the devotees, the non-devotees, are all within the system of Krishna. So we're always advised not to keep trying, not to keep looking for solutions outside of Krishna. Stick with Krishna. Try to keep pleasing Krishna. Understand that actually if we want to satisfy everyone, Because their satisfaction is given to them through Krishna, who's the reservoir of all pleasure, the reservoir of all bliss. We simply try to please Krishna. When we please Krishna, Krishna expands his reservoir of bliss. Isn't it? That's the natural situation of the infinitesimal soul in interaction with the supreme soul, Krishna. It's not that there's no impact on Krishna. When a living entity offers some service to Krishna, Krishna is pleased. He's not completely neutral. He doesn't think, okay, all right then. You did it fine. He's not thinking that. Krishna's thinking, this devotee offered me service. I'm feeling more happy now. So although Krishna doesn't need anything, there's all these paradoxes. That Krishna feels happy. His pleasure expands. Himself as the ocean of pleasure, already unlimited, expands even more. If Krishna, the ocean of pleasure, expands more and more and more, do we think that every single living entity who doesn't draw upon that ocean for their sustenance, do we think that those individuals won't feel happier? Of course they'll feel happier. When Krishna is pleased, so many things happen. So many entities, so many persons benefit in this world despite doing completely the wrong things due to Krishna's mercy. Isn't it? So many people are behaving in so many sinful ways in so many countries of the world. All countries of the world. But somehow, sometimes they appear to be very opulent. They appear to have facilities. They appear to have something. When Krishna is satisfied, sometimes he can distribute his pleasure, his mercy to all those, even if they may be acting contrary at the moment. Krishna is very kind. He's very special. He somehow manages all these factors. He manages a person's karma. He manages a country's karma. He manages the interactions of the families, all that karma that involves. He manages the interaction of the karma between every living entity and every other living entity. Now that's quite an exponential calculation if you do it. That's quite a large number of possible interactions. You could probably not even count them, or even provide a number for them. Impossible to compute. But Krishna is doing that. So he's doing a lot. A lot of it's imperceptible. A lot of it will never be known because Krishna. First of all, we can't understand because Krishna is doing things at a scale that we can't even comprehend. When sometimes parents do things for the child, they do so many more things than the child even understands. The child might understand, okay, the parent is feeding me right now, or the parent is giving me a toy. But they don't understand that the parent is doing so much more than that. That they're maintaining the house, they're earning money, they're dealing with all the difficulties. They're doing all these things. The child just simply doesn't know. So we are like that, with our infinitesimal nature, and then also with our covered nature here in this material world. While we're under the dualities of life, we're in a conditioned state. Our ability to comprehend what the Lord is doing is minuscule. It is so small. So therefore, let's not judge the Lord. Let's not consider whether what he has done is sufficient or suitable or correct. Let's bow to better judgment, his better judgment. Let's defer to his better judgment. And take shelter of the devotees, because the devotees are his representatives. So if we somehow take shelter of Maharaj Yudhishthir, Arjun, Draupadi, Queen Kunti, Bhishma Dev, so many others, then Krishna will be pleased. And he will help us in our spiritual life. So I'll stop there. Does anyone have any questions, comments? Gautama Prabhu? He probably considered it for a short period of time, but his whole agenda in coming there was not an entirely wholesome one to start with. So it was assumed and sort of understood by Durvasa Muni that he's doing something that's questionable at best. So the question is, okay, one, my initial attempt has already been thwarted by in a manner that Krishna has done so comprehensively. Do I want to go back for a second helping? That's probably the calculation that Durvasa Muni made. That I've already made this offense, and I was about to make more, and Krishna has just given me like a warning shot here. He's just dealt with it. I just better go. So that could be a perspective. Best not to entangle yourselves too much if it's going against you. Srinivas Prabhu?
In the story of Bansur by the thousand monks, in the 10th canto, it mentioned that because he took to his side, and we were all children to his side fighting against Krishna, right?
Mm.
It mentioned that Lord Shiva did that to enhance Krishna's
effort. Yeah. Absolutely, definitely. Nothing happens without Krishna's sanctions, and his devotees do not act without Krishna's sanction either. So yes, when they act, there is something special going on. And certainly the whole fight between Lord Shiva with the Shiva Jwara and the Narayan Jwara, in the Narayanastra, you know, that happened during that episode. An amazing battle. It was astounding for everyone who saw it. Lord Shiva's power fighting against Lord Narayan's power. What's going to happen? It was such a fantastic affair. Lord Shiva has done many interesting things in the whole course of events with Krishna and the Pandavas and through the Mahabharata, some which we find difficult to understand. His help given to certain parties, his turning a blind eye to certain things going on, as when the five sons of Draupadi were being killed. Lord Shiva's presence was there, different places, different times. But there's a bigger plan in place, and a great devotee like Lord Shiva knows how to enhance and contribute to that plan. Just as Narad Muni knows how to do the same. When he sometimes spices up a particular episode, he adds a bit of, you know, something, a bit of zing to something, by doing what seems to be the opposite way, by encouraging Ravana to do something. By, you know, encouraging a demon to do something which he shouldn't. Kamsa, so many things. So yeah, very special. That's on the platform of the higher. Krishna's pastimes happen on multiple platforms. The higher platform and the immediate platform, immediately visible platform. And many platforms in between. Any other points anyone would like to raise? Yes? Ms. Kinshin, a problem? What will actually happen depends upon how Krishna conscious they become. If they do not progress too far in their Krishna consciousness, at some point they will try to fulfill that desire. And the idea of taking revenge is nothing new in the world. It's kind of us attempting to fulfill the role of karma. If we actually think about it very carefully, us taking revenge on someone is us attempting to act as the adjudicator for karma. That I want to be the one who wields Yamasya Dandat, the rod of chastisement of Yamaraj. This person must be punished by me because he has wronged me. So in itself, for a devotee, it's not the best attitude. But if the person is not fully a devotee, they're still going to have that attitude. So in the material world, that's what happens. One person wrongs another, another person takes revenge. It goes on and on and on, round and round, and they are both in the material world for a long time. So if a person becomes very Krishna conscious, then they might get to the stage of all the characters in our Shastra. They might come to the stage of Dharma, the bull, who says, who is to blame? When Parikshit Maharaj asks him, who has done this to you? Dharma says, understanding who is to blame is a very difficult concept. How can I say who's to blame? He gives an entire philosophical answer, even though the rogue is standing right next to him, causing him direct harm. He is still the victim, is saying, what is the cause of this? How do we understand it? So for a devotee, it's not particularly sensible to harbor a feeling of revenge or anything like that. It's of no real value. Why should we expend more of our energy trying to be like Yamaraj or trying to be like Krishna? It's not our role. It's just a waste of time for someone who's highly devotionally minded. But for someone who's not, it may be a valid consideration. And then the person has to figure out how to do it. We see the demigods sometimes take revenge for things. You know, when their positions are usurped, they take preemptive measures to maintain their position, status, or whatever it is. And ultimately, the desire to take revenge is a call for maintaining my position, status, or ego. Often it's ego. My ego has been bruised by this person. I must take revenge. I will do something, either passively or aggressively. Or you have a specific psychological trait these days, passive-aggressive type, which has some interesting behaviors. So yeah, the person is going to, he might try. What can you advise such a person? Very difficult. If they're not actually at a stage of Krishna conscious advancement, even if you say everything that I've just said, the first part of my answer, it won't go in. It will have no effect on them. Do you get involved with trying to give them a more sane method by which they could achieve their objectives? Yes, perhaps. Yes, that happens. In the Bhagavatam, different persons have approached Krishna or approached their spiritual master in one sense. Diti approaches Kashyapa when she wants some revenge to be taken against Indra. Right? So she wants a son who can kill Indra. And yes, then the saintly person may give them some advice. And in her case, she was given the Pumsavana ritual to follow, which was something that completely purified her. So what may be possible is that we acknowledge that the person has a desire. We acknowledge that the person may independently try to fulfill their desire. But we try to give them, if possible, a shastric method or a shastric recipe by which someone's desires can be fulfilled. And maybe that can be the best sort of intermediate step. Our shastras are vast and they contain many lessons, many episodes, because what life presents to us is also vast. And the standard dogmatic line, just chant Hare Krishna and forget about everything, is not the correct advice for everyone at all times. Although it is the correct advice, if someone follows it, for everyone at all times, it is the correct advice. It might not be the thing you say to someone who has absolutely no interest in it and no faith in it. So our shastras are full of intelligent advice, and they're full of systems and processes that one can follow if one is not on that pure devotional platform, or if one isn't attracted to the pure devotional platform, at least in terms of the process. So that can be a suggestion that we look from the scripture, and there are many examples of how individuals do things in order to exact revenge on someone else or to achieve something. You know, even in some of the benedictions that are given as the Shruti Phal, you know, after some episodes or chapters, it said, if one does this, one will be able to vanquish all his enemies. The desire for revenge is part of that, right? Vanquishing enemies. So it's possible. So give them a solid Krishna conscious process which may or may not achieve that goal. It depends on whether they follow the process or not. But it will have such a good side effect. Their devotion and their fundamental tendencies will disappear, as happened with Dhruva Maharaj also.
Or chanting 16 rounds, following the principles, reading Prabhupada's books.
Yes.
If they still have these tendencies, then I guess we should really be giving them the proper body drink. You know.
Maybe. But it's an indicator that if they are already, have all the qualifications you've mentioned, they're initiated, they've been following a process for many years, they're following the regulative principles, but they're still harboring this, it means it may not be sufficient. It means their practice is not at a level, or possibly also, and it requires us to take the humble position also, that maybe our presentation is not sufficiently powerful to have impact on them. That's always a good way to look at things. But there's, you know, the power of our presentation, which comes from our adhikar and how much power Krishna gives us to act on his behalf. And then there's also the fact that there's Krishna's hand. And this person might not actually have his eyes opened to be able to understand the wonderful things you're saying to them. Because there might be some offenses which are closing their heart to actually knowing, to actually absorbing what they should be doing. So you still have to deal with that. Just because one is initiated or one is advanced in some, by some metric, experienced maybe, it does not negate that. And I mean, after all, those devotees who are in the process, they're hearing all the standard stuff anyway all the time. If they're not actually surrendered to someone who can, like the guru, cut, and for them to be able to accept that, if they're not on that platform, then you may have to take a more tactical approach without compromising principles. And that is sometimes required also. And it's very much necessary. We cannot assume that whenever someone comes to devotional life, they remain on a high platform throughout their entire devotional career. Many devotees slip off that high platform. Many devotees' practices go down, even after they've acquired different statuses, you know, like initiated, second initiated, potentially guru, potentially sannyasi, potentially maybe a big position. None of this negates the fact that one's actual spiritual progress could still go down. And it might. So we also need good systems to help such people without judging them. We need systems, and we need people who can actually help people, because a lot of devotees, and I would probably be bold enough to say the majority of devotees, will have to deal with maybe aspects of their behavior which are not at the standard that they would have liked after making substantial commitments. And so we need systems to help devotees come back up to the correct standard. So we need that. And if we can think how to do that and how to bring advanced people into contact, people who are expert in different areas to help, this is a big need. It's a big need in any congregation and in any society. That it's not just a case of grabbing whoever you can find who's receptive to the message. It's a case of also, how do you now help a person who is inadvertently, due to their own previous conditionings, and maybe due to their own poor practice, or maybe just due to some big whack that comes to them from an episode of material life, are now not able to perform and conduct themselves to the extent that they thought they would be able to. If we ignore this, well, there's a good chance, I would suggest, maybe 60 to 70% of our devotees might disappear. They might go. And we can just focus on getting more and more and more and more people. But they're all slipping. So let's think. And of course, we can't do anything good for anyone else unless we sort ourselves out, in all honesty. We've got some work to do ourselves. But if we stick to the process and we ask Krishna to compensate for our shortcomings, then he will allow us to act as instruments to help people. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you very much. Grantharatrimad Bhagavatam ki.